You're listening to Reality Sandwich Radio, where every Thursday at noon we serve up a palatable taste of the truth on topics of the mind, body, spirit, and our planet, community, and economy. To learn more about the Healthful Living model, go to healthfulliving.org. Reality Sandwich is hosted by Julie Matthews, Certified Nutrition Consultant, and Martin Matthews, Certified Medical Hypnotherapist. Past episodes of Reality Sandwich are available for free download at realitysandwichradio.com. Thanks for listening.
You are listening to KPOO San Francisco 89.5 FM. You've reached Julie Matthews. I'm a certified nutrition consultant with Healthful Living, and you are listening to our radio show, Reality Sandwich, a palatable taste of the truth, where every Thursday at noon we talk about topics of the mind, body, and our planet. And so today I have a wonderful guest on that I'm very excited to introduce to all of you. Her name is Kyra Bobinette, and she's an MD and the CEO of InterAge Research, and is a national trainer and speaker of human development for education, legal, nonprofit, corporate, and medical professionals. Dr. Bobinette is also the founder of Vision Youths, a San Francisco-based organization dedicated to holistic personal transformation for youth leaving detention. From this work, she authors the blog and resource website teenwhispering.com in order to transform adult-teen relationships. She graduated from the University of California, San Francisco School of Medicine. She serves on the IRIS Alliance Fund National Advisory Council and has taught at UCSF Medical School for 6 years. Dr. Bobinette is an enrolled member of the Leech Lake Chippewa tribe and is also of Lakota and Czech descent and is a parent. She lives in the San Francisco Bay Area. And I love this. Promotes the unconditional worth of all beings.
Yes.
Hello, Kyra.
Good morning or good afternoon.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So I just think that this is such an important topic that I don't know about you, but I find that does not get talked about enough.
Mm-mm, mm-mm.
And I had actually several parents call me ahead of time and tell me they were going to listen to the show today
because
they were so excited to hear you.
Yeah, yeah.
So maybe we can just start with the beginning. Your website and your blog is teenwhispering.com.
Yes.
And maybe you can just tell us first, what is Teen Whispering?
So Teen Whispering is basically a communication system for teens, which is developmentally sensitive and supportive to their particular view and lens through life. It's basically switching working against teens to working with teens. So instead of working against them, you work with their normal qualities.
Hmm. And I'm curious what got you into this. I'd love to get a little bit of your history. You were an MD, and then you did this wonderful work with kids coming out of detention. So can you give us maybe a little background on how you got to where you are with Teen Whispering?
Yeah. In 94, I started volunteering in juvenile hall. And what I noticed was the fellow volunteers, as well as other teachers, parents, even physicians, always addressed teenagers in a pretty combative way. One time I was with a physician working with street youth, and one patient came in and the physician said something like, you know, so to earn money, you're what, prostituting your body? And I just remember so many moments where I felt really mortified of how teens were talked to. They were either talked to like they were children or that they were already supposed to be adults, and so they were judged for not being up to par.
Hmm. Wow. So you've created this, where do I want to take from that? So one of the things that you really talk about that I find really wonderful is your ability to be sensitive towards the development of teens and kind of where they are at this point, and how the development, you talk about the development of children and the development of adults being very different than the development or the needs of teenagers.
Mm-hmm.
And it sort of seems like it just gets lost in the shuffle.
Mm-hmm.
So what does it mean to be sensitive to the teen's developmental needs?
Well, I have to say, first of all, that, you know, there's been a shift already with the younger population. So back in the 70s, even the beginning of the 80s, there was a lot of spanking of children.
Mm-hmm.
And we have, a legislative movement right now to outlaw spanking, which is its own discussion, you know, onto itself. But what happened was that there was a shift in consciousness of parents and people who wanted to do something new. And so that basically birthed the timeout. And so, you know, we went from a violence with between the parent and child to a nonviolent approach to the same type of teaching. And I think at the same level, people are now looking for, you know, how do I address teens? Because they seem to be this very complex, a lot of people think they're difficult. Mm-hmm. You know, I had some parents tell me the other day that, you know, when they tell in, you know, social circles that they have a teenager, that, you know, the response is, oh, good luck with that,
right.
You know, dot, dot, dot. And so there's just this bad reputation. And I think people would address it differently if they had skills and if they knew how. So developmentally sensitive means that we're going to stop importing techniques and methods that, you know, were really developed for either adults or children and trying to extrapolate them for use with teens, which is not as, I think, accurate or exacting as teens are. You know, they have priorities such as risk-taking, secrecy. They pay a lot of attention to power issues and status issues, and they're very self-absorbed. And all those things are normal, natural, and necessary for them to go from a child mindset to a more autonomous adult mindset.
And it is interesting how we don't, I don't know if we don't value that or we don't understand it. I don't know if you have any more insight into that. But then what I find happens is that then teens can feel that. And I know for myself it sort of felt like there's this, it's awkward enough to be a teen. And then to have the people that are responding to you not really get you even more, I think it just makes it a really difficult time for everybody.
Yeah, I think, you know, they're left and abandoned by the teen in the adult. So when you look at it from a developmental standpoint, the adult is also part teen at times, and they have certain resonance with the issues or the struggles that the adolescent is having. And whenever they face those head on, it basically makes them feel uncomfortable, makes the adult feel uncomfortable that this is happening, because it makes them also remember how it felt to be a teen. And so there's this sort of pushing away from the teen, like, you know, I can't deal with you, I can't deal with that, when in fact teenagers actually are a beautiful mirror for adults, and it's an opportunity to look at the areas where we may not have fully developed and we're still a part teenager in that area. And it because it's so uncomfortable, we get to say, why do I care what that person thinks of me?
Right.
Why do I care what I look like? Why do I still care about these things? You know, how can I be free of those things? And teenagers show us exactly where our ego lies.
Now, if we, I don't even know if this exists in the real world, but if we had these model parents that hopefully Teen Whispering is teaching some of these skills, would those of us that are adults still have these teen pieces, or would we have been able to more fully heal or integrate those? I mean, is that because we were somehow slightly stunted because we didn't have the support we needed, or is that just normal human that we all have all of these pieces and they're always going to be there?
So there's a philosophical and there's a biological answer to that. I'm not sure which one you want me to go into, but philosophically speaking, I think that I would expect all of us are every age we've ever been throughout our lives on some level. And we revisit those memories or those behaviors, and we update those as they become no longer useful to us and maybe problematic to how we're, you know, relating to the world. And so I think that, you know, the inner teen, the inner child, even the inner elder in all of us is co-present with us at all times. And we can kind of cycle through them based on what life is teaching us.
That's very interesting. So what makes Teen Whispering different than all the other self-help teen books and resources out there?
Yeah, well, let me say I like a lot of what's out there. I think there's a lot of good experts who have written, you know, some good books. The thing that I felt was missing was that, you know, teenagers are the most sensitive creatures, if you will, to the nonverbal component of communication. And, you know, since the early 70s, we have documented that, you know, science has figured out that nonverbal communication is, you know, the bulk of what we communicate with one another. So over 90% of everything that we exchange with one another, that we're picking up from one another, is nonverbal communication. So, you know, trainings, books, things that, you know, tell you what to do and what to say are just the very tip of the iceberg. And teen whispering is really trying to get at the energy below that, the silent conversation that's happening, the tone of voice, the body language, the just the energy of communication. And it's really somewhat abstract. And so that's why I've created more of a systematic way of approaching it and teaching it, because, you know, people have experienced the rolling of eyes from teenagers, but they don't really know how to prevent it. And they don't know how to respond to it. And they don't, they're not aware of what impact it's having on them and how it changes what they say next.
Right. They may not even know what it means. I mean, I think most people would think that rolling your eyes is just, oh, that person's being difficult, or, but not realizing that there's something behind why they're having that reaction. So how did you come up with the idea for teen whispering?
Well, it's been about 20 years in the making. I would say that the highlighting turning point, though, was the beginning of volunteering with juvenile delinquents in juvenile hall. The first day I ever went, I'll never forget this, I was a first-year medical student, and I came into this room in one of the units that was for more of the severe offenders. And these are all boys that are waiting for trial or, you know, waiting to be placed elsewhere, and so they're very, very stressed out. And the counselors had helped put them in this classroom, which is, you know, linoleum floored, and it was, it's not, I guess they have a new facility now, but it was a very sort of rundown facility at the time. And they would just pack them in there, and there was about 30 boys, and then there was me and three other medical students, and they were all female. And so I went in to observe, and it was, there was no classroom management whatsoever. The youth were walking all over the instructors. They were, you know, passing notes and making little snide remarks and, you know, joking with each other. And the medical students were sitting there going, you guys, listen up, you guys, you know, just kind of pushing on with their agenda,
right,
and losing the students, you know, for about, you know, 90% of the time. What happened was I noticed there was this, an exchange between these two boys across the room throughout the class. And it was a two-hour class, and they built up more and more. They kept giving each other what they call mugging, you know, bad looks. And they kept sort of whispering things at each other. And I saw this coming. So they line up to get out of the room. And all of a sudden, one boy clocks the other one in the back of the head. And they start this rumble. They roll to the ground, and there's, you know, all this, you know, blood from one of them's nose and one of them's lip. And, you know, I was totally shocked. And it was very scary. And it was very, you know, it was a very tight environment. And it was like, it was like a fire in a small, you know, contained area. What I saw happen to me, my response, was I summoned this energy, this directive within me. And I was like, stay back, you know, stop, to the other boys. And just the energy of what I said, even though my physical being was not big enough to stop them, it gave them A, an excuse to not get involved, and B, it tapped into their sort of inner child, which would respond to an adult, you know, responding to them that way. And what I noticed is that, you know, from that point forward, I could always navigate and negotiate with adolescents based on my tone, based on how I presenced myself, you know, and how intentional I was about what I was saying.
We had talked at a past time that we had met, and you were talking about boundaries and children and adolescents and the need for that. So I'd love for you to describe that piece of it, and that I feel like you're kind of tapping into that. You were giving some directive and sort of being in charge in that moment, and that adolescents do test those boundaries but really need somebody. So can you describe that a little bit more?
Yeah, I had this actually was taught to me by a dog, which I love animals. So when I refer to analogies having to do with animals, I mean no disrespect or, you know, towards humans. But my friend had this dog named Oso, and she, you know, admittedly said the dog was probably, you know, very, very dumb in its, cerebral capacity. It wasn't a very smart dog. And this dog had a very big body. It was a bull mastiff breed. And she said that it had this way of having to have physical contact with everything as a way of relating to its world. So you would be there, and the dog would come to you, and then it would immediately brush up against you and almost push you over, because it was about a 120-pound dog. And what I realized is that teenagers are doing this. You know, they need to push. They need to feel the resistance of life pushing back at them. Because what they're doing is they're starting to, you know, extend. Children just say, okay, you know, I won't cross the street, or okay, I won't touch that. Mm-hmm. Adolescents are like, okay, how far can I take this? How much can I do this? Because they have to develop that, their own measures of that, mm-hmm. in order to be self-sufficient adults. You know, so I think one of the most annoying things for adults is that they're constantly being pushed on, especially the closer you are, like parents, they get this all the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so if the youth or if the adolescent trusts you the most, you're the one they're going to kind of cut their teeth on, you know, and it's really, it wears out a lot of parents. It wears out a lot of teachers. And I just explained to them, this is normal, natural, and necessary. It doesn't mean you have to let down and let them win all the time. But it also means that you are not going to engage them with an oppositional approach.
Mm.
You know, so team whispering is about sort of redirecting that energy instead of, you know, being a lock horns, you know, straight on, head-to-head, butting heads.
Mm-hmm.
You're trying to use their force to give them a sense of resistance, but also not to crush them,
mm-hmm.
which is what usually people do when they're dealing with children.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. So you have a very fascinating background, and I would love to know how that contributes to teen whispering.
Okay. So yeah, I'm sort of a quilt, if you will, of many different traditions, many different learnings and trainings. I guess the main thing that I represent is a composite of human development approaches that have been developed, you know, throughout time. So I first came to know human development through medicine wheel, through my Native American heritage, and learned that there was life stages. There was, you know, birth and teen and adult and elder, and those were very different roles to play mm-hmm. in a community, and they each had their own place. They each had their own beauty, and they each had their own learnings that needed to happen.
Mm.
Then I went to medical school at UCSF, and we learned a lot of Western models. You know, they usually have names attached to them. So Erickson, Piaget, Maslow's, all of these scientists who have basically said, okay, growth is happening, and it happens in this stage, stage one, and then this stage, stage two, this is what happens, and stage three, this is what happens. And I found that their staging of it basically mirrored or was very parallel to the medicine wheel constructs that I had been exposed to.
Mm.
So I looked into those more, and I was mapping those together. Meanwhile, you know, this is the Bay Area, so I started to explore more. You know, what else exists? You know, I came across something called the chakra system, which is the energetic centers for Eastern medicine in your body. And each of those has certain developmental themes, and they seem to run in parallel with the other two models or the other two lineages that I had been studying. And then, you know, mandalas, which is a sort of a more of a Buddhist or a Tibetan psychological tool, also had very similar themes. So I think, you know, what I came to, you know, understand is that all these themes are running along the same essential channels, and that just like if you have DNA in you, DNA in me, DNA in fish, you know, we're all using the same biological molecules to live,
mm-hmm.
you know, similarly, we're all using the same patterns essentially to grow.
Hmm. Very interesting. And so you found, I'm guessing that, so you're noticing the growth or the natural stages between the different schools of thought had a lot of similarity between them. And,
yeah.
and you were able to, so you, in your work with teen whispering, I'm guessing you pull from all of those different ideas?
Yeah, I think that's what makes it so true to form. You know, in my situation with working with juveniles in detention, because there were so many barriers to cross, you know, gender, age, life experience, culture, they were from all over the planet, you know. And I think that the human development information was transcendent to those more, you know, particular ways of being.
Hmm.
You know, I was able to see themes that underlied and united every human.
Hmm.
And so I didn't see them as so different, but I also was able to be more sensitive to who they were and what they needed from me.
Hmm. So for people that are just tuning in, you are listening to KPOO San Francisco. I'm Julie Matthews, and I am here with Kyra Bobinette from teenwhispering.com. And by the way, what did you study in medical school? What was your specialty?
I actually started a youth organization after medical school, so I didn't go into residency.
Okay.
I'm now doing public health.
Okay.
So, you know, that's sort of my specialty.
Okay. Yeah. And tell me more. You found it. What was this organization that you founded?
It's called Vision Youths.
Okay.
And it was an extension of my juvenile hall volunteering in medical school. And what I realized is that there was a group of teenagers who were so misunderstood, that were being just recycled through the prison system. And there was sort of this channel leading from juvenile to adult prison. And my challenge was to find a way to divert that path, to provide an exit ramp for that, you know, prison industrial complex.
Mm-hmm.
It's not accidental, and it has almost a gravitational force once you get into the system. And so the idea was to empower young people through inner awareness, through being aware of the mental patterns of their thoughts, of their emotions, and using that to improve their behavioral health and their choices, and as well as giving them sort of external supports through case management and, you know, plugging them into things that already exist. Excuse me.
Wow. And did you find that most of these children had parents that were incarcerated, or was it just a... I mean, is there a particular background that you found that ended up in these facilities over and over again? Or was it really just that you get in there and then it just continues to perpetuate itself?
I would say that the pattern that I noticed most often is that if you had the money to defend yourself, you really didn't end up in juvenile hall. You ended up in some wilderness camp out in Utah.
Okay, well, enough
said
on that.
That's a whole other social commentary.
Right. That I'm sure prison focus would be very interested in.
Yeah, exactly.
So your mentor, Curtis, inspired you to call it Whispering. Can you describe who he was and what that was?
Yeah. So Curtis Wright is a mentor of mine. He's actually the reason why I started teaching it to others. So, you know, the youth taught it to me of how to whisper just by force of, you know, survival.
Mm-hmm.
I had to do that because my ego was being built, you know, beat up so much. I needed to learn another way to work with them instead of against them. And I, along the way, met Curtis. So Curtis is African American and Native American mixed. And he sort of raised himself out in the desert outside of LA and grew up in Compton and was a high school teacher here in the Bay Area before he moved last year. He is essentially the most brilliant, emotionally intelligent teacher I've ever known, and is able to work with people on a level that I hope to achieve someday. The thing that inspired me about him was he had worked with a man named Monty Roberts, and Monty Roberts is famous in horse training circles for essentially being one of the individuals, the key individuals, to shift the approach to horses of breaking them. Horse training used to be very abusive, and, you know, we must, you know, get this horse to succumb to us, and, you know, we have to break his spirit or her spirit. And it was very violent. And Monty's own father, as he described, was always beating horses, and it really tore him up as a kid. And so when it came his turn to learn how to train horses, he took a different path. He went out into the desert, and he spent about 10 years studying Mustangs. And through this study, what he picked up was that there was this whole language that Mustangs were using with one another to get each member of the herd to respond a certain way so they could kind of go together, travel together. And he started to mimic this body language or these behaviors with the horses that he was training, and found that indeed you could work with instead of against the horse. And so he taught Curtis has also applied it to, you know, other animals as well as all people. And so I think it's really about shifting, you know, at least with teen communication, from an oppositional, dominant, submissive form to more of a cooperative form. And that's what he was about.
Wow.
Yeah.
Boy, when you said that breaking their spirit, that I could certainly relate to that. It's really heart-wrenching. And I'm curious how that impacts a child or youth growing up when the approach isn't the teen whispering approach, but is more of the let's get you to obey because life is dangerous out there and you need this kind of approach. I can only imagine it does not do good things for the individual over the long term.
Yeah, I would say it's probably the source of a lot of what we see with, judgment of one another. Mm. You know, I just got back from New York last night, and, you know, when human beings have to wait for one another in the security line, you know, again, Teen Whispering's all about, you know, the nonverbal, I can tell that they're all judging one another, you know, and that comes from having been judged, having been taught to behave through criticism instead of celebrating your own internal motive to do well, to be well, and to serve others.
Hmm. Going on to some just, I guess, you talk about two types of fights. Those are sort of two types. Mm-hmm. Can you describe those a little bit?
Yeah. So at some point I had this realization that, you know, we could simplify this by saying that adults and teens are only having two fights. Okay. So, again, looking through a developmental lens, you have the adolescent life stage or the teens, and then you have the adult life stage, the adults. And each of those has uniquely characteristic profiles of, things that they pay attention to, things, approaches they would use. And what happens in fights is that, you know, you either have the adult kind of slipping backwards in time and becoming either a teen or even a younger child.
Mm-hmm.
Or you have them issuing demands on the teen, you know, that, you know, why are you so irresponsible? You know, why didn't you remember your homework? Why didn't you, you know, what's wrong with you kind of thing? Because they're expecting the teen to already be an adult.
Mm.
So, you know, it's more convenient for an adult to have the teen, you know, have these measures of being an adult instead of being a teen, because then they can issue all of these, you know, well, it's your fault, you know, and they don't have to look at themselves.
Right.
So it's a way of hiding.
Mm. And you say that it's a teen whispering as a system of communication.
Mm-hmm.
So can you describe the system?
Yeah. So back in medical school, I had the opportunity to learn outdoor survival, wilderness survival, from a man named Tom Brown Jr. And he was trained by an Apache scout. And what he teaches his students is something called the Sacred Order of Survival, because, you know, he's a world-renowned tracker. He can tell footprints that are, you know, weeks old and, you know, track you down in the wilderness. And so he was employed a lot to find people who had gone missing in the wilderness. Mm. And what he always found was that they died of exposure, not of starvation.
Mm.
You know, and as a result, he wanted to teach us, you know, you have to, if you're lost, you have to go for shelter first, and then food is last.
Interesting.
You know, of your immediate concerns. Mm-hmm. In the same way, I wanted to give people a way of looking at communication where they could most reliably look at, you know, if I do this piece and I make sure that's solid, then I do this piece and I make sure that's solid, I'm going to have the best possible success. Mm-hmm. You know, not every interaction, because you have another person involved.
Right.
But in terms of the maximum of what you can contribute and what you can do and the wisdom with which you are, you know, making your own choices, the system goes in four steps. So the first step is profiling.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of people jump into communicating without any thought of, you know, what's my mood? What's their mood?
Mm.
What are my needs? What are their needs? You know, so there's no sort of pause for, you know, who is communicating right now?
Right.
You know, because Kyra today versus Kyra last night, two different Kyras. You know, last night I was groggy and grumpy, and today I'm refreshed and I'm fine. You know, you as well, you'll have, you know, 26 different iterations of yourself just today.
Yes.
And so it's wise to always start with profiling. Mm. Then you can go to the second step, which is self-care. And I basically have to twist people's arms around this, because they're most resistant to taking time out for themselves. That's not how we're trained. That's not how we're conditioned to believe or think. But you have to have enough to give. Whispering is an art. It only happens when you have enough to give to the process.
Mm.
So if you're in survival mode, you're not whispering. You have no chance of whispering.
Right.
You got to stop at self-care. Mm. And then if you make it past self-care, the third step is buy-in. And this is essentially my way of describing the modern adult tendency to lecture or to have an agenda and try to just get through that agenda regardless of where the teen is at.
Right.
So they lose them in the process. And so I try to teach folks how to be aware of whether they have the youth buying in or not. And then the final thing is all of the sort of fundamental and more fancy techniques, which are, you know, developmentally based.
In terms of self-care, boy, most of us don't think we have the time or the ability, or but maybe you can explain why finding time for self-care is so important.
Oh, man, it's never enough words about self-care. I think, you know, we in this society have only two modes. We have the go-go-go mode or the burnout mode. Mm-hmm. You know, so people go until they just absolutely can't go anymore, and then they either take a vacation or they – but that's really just getting them back up to where they were before, mm-hmm. where they can drain themselves out again.
Right.
What I'm talking about is actually getting ahead of the game, you know, creating an energetic savings account mm-hmm. where you have – you know, some choices of which how to spend your energy. And that's what teens require. I think why people see teens as so exhausting is that they do tap into, you know, how much do you have to give to another, you know, and they will tap into that and they will drain it. And then people feel empty. So, you know, I have a lot of people who, a lot of clients and students who are adults who say, you know, well, you know, so my child or my client, my teen client is doing this, they're doing that, how can we fix them?
Right.
And I always ask them, well, how much are you putting into yourself? You know, how solid are you? So, well, I'm exhausted. I'm whatever. I said, well, that's your starting point. Because they want to know about steps 3 and 4
right.
before they do 1 and 2.
Right. And yeah. so what happens if they don't do 1 and 2?
They basically, you know, get in over their heads. So they'll go ahead and they'll go into this communication, which is very complex. Let's say you're talking about, you know, something really hard, like, you know, sexuality, or you're talking about, you know, negotiating, you know, going out or making a plan for change. And you have to touch on buttons that the teen is going to give you a lot of resistance on. You don't make it very far.
Mm-hmm.
You basically get in over your head, and then you find yourself needing more from the conversation than they do, and you're competing with them for attention in the same conversation. The second thing that can happen if you go in without self-care is that you, because you're not paying attention to them and what they need, because you don't have enough to pay attention to them, you'll miss what they're asking. You'll miss what they're even telling you. You know, all the cues are there. All the clues that you need are there, but you're so in yourself, in your head, that you're not at peace and not able to receive that information.
Right.
There's no space.
Right.
Yeah.
So step 3 being buy-in.
Mm-hmm.
So how are you using this term? It's used a lot in different contexts, from business to all sorts of things. So what does that mean in this case?
Yeah. So buy-in was something I did just instinctively. And how I learned to teach it was, again, through Curtis and through Monty Roberts, because Curtis gave me this video about Monty Roberts training a horse. And it showed that the horse basically has 4 body language signs that it's willing to work with you. So Monty takes a horse into a round pen, and the horse is, you know, trying to get away from him. And he runs around and around and around, and Monty runs him down until he's tired. And at some point, the horse is so tired that he starts to come away from the wall towards the trainer, towards Monty. And that's sign number 1. And then he basically starts licking and chewing and turning one ear towards Monty, saying, okay, you've got my attention, and I'm feeling, you know, pretty positive towards you, licking and chewing. And then the final sign is when the horse drops his head, which is that I will do whatever you say. You know, so in the same way, I tried to make a parallel with teenagers. So buy-in with them looks like, you know, number 1, you have to have their attention. You know, so many times I see teachers lecturing when the class is sort of, you know, picking their nose or, you know, passing notes or whatever they're doing. They're just not locked onto the teacher's voice. So we call that, you know, teaching without students. The second sign is that they have to ask you for something. There has to be a need. You know, it can't just, these are not children anymore. You can't just say because I said so. You know, and that's the developmental threshold that people assume, you know, especially parents are prone to this. They assume that because their lovely, shiny child used to care, that they had no reason for what they asked them to do. They just, you know, unequivocally said, yes, mom, yes, dad, or whatever. Now they actually have to have a reason because the teen is challenging that, you know. So the teen has to be able to ask you. You have to be a person who delivers a specific need that they want. And you have to find a way to put yourself in that position in their lives. The third sign of buy-in is that they actually disclose something meaningful to you. The important thing here is that it's a meaningful disclosure, you know, like they tell you a secret, or they, you know, trust you with some information that is difficult, and you can kind of get a sense for that. And then the final sign of buy-in is whether they follow a command. So, for example, I did not have buy-in this last weekend. I went to a detention center, and this was, you know, maybe my second or third time meeting this one young man in a group teaching setting, so I have not spent individual time with him. And he was in the most sour mood and, you know, was basically undermining the entire class the entire time. I had taken a different set of students away for a different lesson, came back to the larger group for the closing part of the class, and he was being so toxic that, you know, when he left the class, I said, "Hey, you know, hey, come here," you know, that kind of thing. And he didn't. He totally turned his back and walked away. And that to me is just a sign of, okay, you know, I didn't have that agreement with him. Mm-hmm. You know, I haven't reached that level of buy-in with him. I don't have buy-in with him. So I'm not going to make any efforts until I start to build up the relationship with him.
So what do parents do if they don't have buy-in yet?
Well, it depends on where you're going wrong. You know, I mean, if, for example, you are not getting their attention, you have to stop right there. You have to surprise them. You have to, you know, shock them. You have to challenge them. You know, some way that makes you a person of interest. You know, Curtis, one time I saw him sort of throw a book in the center of a room to get the whole class to stop. And then he didn't say, "Listen to me." He looked away from them. But he had gotten their attention, and he had made himself sort of somebody to track, somebody to keep an eye on the whole time, you know, because then they're suspicious of you.
Right.
And likewise, if they're not asking you anything for anything, it means that they have no need for you. You have to track their needs and say, okay, what does this person need? What do they want? And how do I become the source of that?
Right.
You know, for me to be a vital person. And then the third one, disclosing. If they're not disclosing anything to you, it usually means that you're talking too much.
Ah.
You know, I took a trip with some young people in Yosemite, and there was adults and there was young people, and there was about 10 of us all together. And so it was a pretty big group to hike, you know, 23 miles or whatever over 4 days. And at the beginning, I challenged the adults to only teach using questions. And I cannot tell you how hard it was.
It's hard.
Because they're so into telling.
Yes.
You know, and instructing. And, you know, just on these long raves about, you know, this is what I know about this topic, you know. And they're so used to that. But they didn't leave any room in that case for the young people to discover or to be curious. So, you know, disclosing came once the youth realized that we were there to listen, you know. And then the final one, following commands or following requests, I usually, if I'm not getting a result from a teen, I usually do something that links it to their self-image. For example, you know, can you help me lift this thing because I know that they think they're strong.
That makes a lot of sense. And
yeah.
Makes them feel like there's some worth to that process. So what methods do you recommend as part of team whispering?
Well, you know, just like with anything, you got to have the basics down before you get fancy. So I've divided it up into the sort of beginner set, which is the fundamentals.
Okay.
And then the more sort of developmentally, you know, tricky and fancy set.
Okay.
So I always check folks for, you know, how sound their fundamentals are. You know, fundamentals are trust. For example, I knew one mother who, she didn't know this, but her daughter had noticed her gossiping to her daughter all the time about other people, about her clients, et cetera, et cetera. And this sent a message to the daughter that, look, you know, if I'm talking about all these other people to you, guess what?
Yes.
I'm talking about you to everybody else.
Right.
So her daughter really didn't want to disclose to her anything. You know, mother tried to do all these more fancy methods, but didn't realize that there was kind of a hole in the ship with her fundamentals. You know, so that's trust.
Are there any other fundamentals before we get to fancy?
Yeah, there's actually three others.
Okay.
One is respectful language. You know, the most egregious example I can give about that is one father who said something like to his daughter, you're such a loser. You're never going to be anything, you know, in a moment of rage, you know, admittedly. But if you've got that kind of language going on, you're really not ready for, you know, developmentally sensitive language. You're really trying to clean up something that you were taught that is toxic, you know, and things that are toxic for teens include criticism, judgment, the use of always or never, such a prison for them, and also futurizing. So the fact that the father said, you will never be blank,
right?
You know, it's particularly harmful for young people because they are so insecure about where they're heading or who they're going to be. For you to forecast for them that message gets in their head and they start to play it out, you know,
definitely,
as adults.
Wow.
So then the other one is detachment. There's this story that is not true, but it's a good analogy of, you know, baby birds falling out of a nest. You know, we were all taught, do not touch the baby bird.
Right.
Because if the baby bird falls out of the nest and you put him back, the mother bird will smell that and then abandon the baby.
Right.
In the same way, teens have dreams, hopes, private issues. If the adults in their lives have sort of fingerprints on all of their hopes and dreams, they will abandon them just simply out of an instinct to rebel.
Mm.
You know, if they think that, if I think, for example, that you want me to get good grades, you know, your fingerprints are on my good grades.
Right.
I no longer want them.
Ah.
That's my baby bird. I'm going to abandon it,
hmm.
you know, and then, you know, you'll have a hard time getting me to reengage. And I think detachment is realizing that these young people are not an extension of you, whether you're a professional, a therapist, and you think that their healing or their success or their insights are a function of your skills, or let's say you're a parent or a teacher, and they respond beautifully because you have taught them all these glorious, wonderful things in life. It's the ability to kind of step back and let them have their success and their failure and not have it be a reflection on you.
Right.
So the fourth fundamental is setting boundaries. And we talked about that a little bit earlier with Oso the dog, you know, just the ability to push back without, you know, being inconsistent. So if they push on Monday and the boundary's there, but they push on Wednesday and it falls down, then you're basically confusing that teen about what they can expect from the outside world.
Right.
Also, if they push you over all the time or kind of eat you up because you have some sort of martyr complex, then you're basically setting them up for failure because the world is not going to take that off of them. You know, people will go away from them if they try to engage the world in that way. So you have to, for their sake and yours, kind of hold your own dignity around how you need to be treated as a teaching to them about how the world is going to respond to them.
That's a really great point. And what about some of the fancier, I love that word, the fancier methods?
So fancier methods, basically this is how I would couch those. There's a martial art called Aikido. And I'll use this analogy just because it's so perfect. Aikido is a non-fighting, more passive way of engaging conflict. So let's say you have somebody attacking you. The goal in Aikido is to redirect that attack energy and to not have it hit you dead on, but to kind of sideswipe you and then use it to the fall of that other person. So the attacker gets redirected and ends up on their back. Because they tried to come at you. And Aikido is the way of flipping that energy from attack to passive defense. In the same way, when teens charge, when teens come at you, a lot of these methods are about doing this Aikido switching, you know, where you make it into something productive. So instead of, you know, if they come at you with a demand that is impossible, and that puts you in a position where, let's say, you know, I want to go see this rated R movie or this NC-17 movie.
Right.
Can I go? Can I go? Can I go? And then you're beyond the child state, so you can't say no because I said so.
Right.
You know, you have to have a reason, you know. How do you address that? You know, and that's a big sticking point for adults because it sets them up to be the source of the teen's suffering, you know, like, no, you can't go. Oh, please, can I please go? You know, and there, you're there,
right.
You know? So now you're locked onto a conflict, you know, and it's just a matter of like, no, I said so. Yes, I need to go, you know, yes, no, yes, no. Instead of that, what you can do is just invite a proposal. So you can invite maturity from them and say, okay, here are your parameters, here are your bumpers. Mm. You know, it needs to be this kind of movie and it needs to have this type of, you know, length or you know, whatever your criteria mm-hmm. is. It needs to be close to home. It needs to be adult chaperoned. It needs to be whatever. And just say, you know, show me how this is going to, how your desire will fit into these parameters.
Mm.
You
great.
Know, and so then it's on them to problem solve, which they love to do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's developmentally hot for them to figure problems out.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you just change the argument, change the topic on them, you know, oh, no, we're not fighting about me not letting you. I'm not the gatekeeper.
Right.
The information is the gatekeeper.
Mm-hmm.
The criteria is the gatekeeper. And you're it's a puzzle for you to figure out.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that's great.
Yeah.
So in addition to redirecting energy, what other types of tools do you use or do you teach?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think a chief one is invisibility. You know, just, again, going with Aikido, you're trying not to be so obvious. You're trying not to be a target
mm-hmm.
and try not to be this sort of person to attack.
Right.
So there was this one story of a counselor that I knew who was trying to teach this young man about anger management. And this young man always had a bad temper. Anything would set him off. And the counselor would discuss this with him, and oh yes, you know I have a problem. I know I lose my temper too quickly. You know, I don't know what to do, et cetera, et cetera. So one day, the counselor decided to be invisible because it wasn't working to have this direct,
mm-hmm.
you know, talking about it. It needed to go into action or to an experience. And so he set up this young man to have this experience where another student, you know, who was his friend, came over to him and basically triggered him on purpose. And then he lost his temper and the counselor was right there. And, you know, then the other student said, well, you know, the counselor told me to set you off. And the young man never forgot that. You know, 10 years later, he tells this story of, you know, I never realized how quickly I lost my temper until that point. But if he had come up to him, the counselor, and said directly, you know, look, man, you need to stop, you know, blah, 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 blah.
Right.
Then he's being a parent again, or he's being mm-hmm. that sort of authority figure. He didn't allow the young person to meet his own fate. Mm. He kind of intervened.
Right.
You know, so he was invisible in that teaching, but he taught it anyway.
Wow. That's really interesting. So you had talked about tone, and it's not what people say, but sometimes how they say it. So how is that part of teen whispering?
Mm. So again, 90% of what we're picking up from one another is nonverbal
mm-hmm.
communication, and no one is more sensitive to that than the adolescent mind.
Mm.
So of course, the primary focus here is how do you look when you're doing it? What are you saying underneath your breath
mm-hmm.
when you're doing it? Your tone. I knew one mother who, you know, had no credibility with her children. She would basically say, you know, clean your room. And the subtext of that was, or I'll say it again. You know, there was no consequence to that. So I think, you know, one thing I teach folks is to seal the exits between, you know, what they want to have happen and the consequences that happen, so that the young person, the teen, only has a choice of meeting with consequence or doing what you had intended them to do.
Mm. So in our last couple minutes here, I'm sure there are a lot of parents that complain about not getting the response they want from their teens, and I don't know if they think they are employing these methods or not, but what do you suggest to those people that might be out there listening saying, this sounds great, but I'm not getting the response I need? What do you say to those parents and adults?
Mm-hmm. So the main thing is to address what might be, again, in that nonverbal communication piece for you. For example, I went to this movie one time when I was visiting my sister, and this young man came out of the movie, and he said something very vulgar to me. He was about 13, and he said, hey, baby, you wanna? And he said something sexual. And he expected me to be, you know, kind of go into my inner teen and have a teen moment and not be able to say anything back,
right.
You know, which used to happen to me all the time when I was a younger lady. But this, at this age, you know, I went directly to him. I was like, yes, you summoned me. Yes. And I kept following him around and he was like trying to escape me, running, you know, between these groups of teens and being like, this lady's coming after me. I didn't mean for this to happen, you know? So I think, you know, it's always going to benefit the adult to, to take it slowly. Mm-hmm. So they have to be in control of the pace, you know, anytime communication goes too fast, it's going to basically default win to the adolescent because they're better at fast. Mm-hmm. We're better at slow. You know, law of conservation of energy is on our side if we slow it down. Mm. The second thing is to try to be as invisible as possible. And the third thing is to go to the hidden subtext of the conversation. So in this case with the movie guy, you know, he didn't expect me to have the guts enough to confront him. Mm-hmm. But in fact, my adult energy was more powerful than his adolescent energy when I went directly to, yes, you know, you want my attention. Yes, mm-hmm. I'm here for you, you know, and he didn't want that. He right. wanted to intimidate me, mm. you know. So the more that you can not be on the surface with the, you know, and go to the I know that you know that I know that you know, that level, mm-hmm. then you're able to penetrate, you know, what's really going on mm. and be able to kind of speak to them what their secrets are.
Wow. Know? This is great. So for people, if they want to find out more about you, they can go to teenwhispering.com. Mm-hmm. And is there anything else in kind of our last minute or so that you'd like to tell people or anything about your services or anything else before?
Well, I think, you know, my main message is that we can work with, not against, teenagers. Mm-hmm. And that the way we do that is to look at how we say things, not what we say, to get away from the surface script of what we need to say and to really focus on who we are in the moment and the energy of communication that underlies and is vital to teen-adult relationships. Mm. And I think people are looking for this. You know, again, going back to the example of, you know, we used to spank our children, or most people used to, you know, spank their children. And then there came this technology around timeouts mm-hmm. that freed a lot of people and gave options, gave choices.
Right.
And I think in the same way, teen whispering is part of that new upgrades of how to manage and honor adolescents where they're at, mm-hmm. but also still hold the dignity and the responsibility of the adult role in place.
Right.
And not to, you know, just let them run amok, especially since, you know, America itself is sort of a giant teenager. You
right.
know, a lot of the characteristics that are so heavily promoted on TV and in the media are things like competition, vanity, materialism, you know, self-absorption, mm-hmm. You know, putting people down, like fear, all those things sort of titillate us. And it hits all of our sort of inner teen. It feeds our inner teen. It makes us feel inadequate, you know. So I think, you know, using these techniques, it helps to mature everybody and helps to, you know, kind of separate out the adults from the teens so that there's somebody who actually can mentor and raise them. Right,
right. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you very much.
It's wonderful to have you.
It's a pleasure.
It's Kyra Bobinette at teenwhispering.com. You have been listening to Reality Sandwich. I'm Julie Matthews, a certified nutrition consultant with Healthful Living. You can find out more about my services at healthfulliving.org. And you can listen to this radio show and any past radio shows at realitysandwichradio.com. Thanks for listening.